You got a little something there on your chin. You might want to clean it up. Okay, guys, we're doing it. Welcome to Thomas DJ's Watching. This is going to be at least once a month, maybe twice a month. I'm not sure yet. A podcast that will be available through the Patreon first, then through, of course, the good folks at Two True Freaks. And what I'm doing is I am watching television. I was going to start with Hannibal, and I will get to Hannibal after I get through with this, I'm assuming, 10-episode run. But something came up that I know a lot of people were very curious about my take on. So we're going to be covering Doom Patrol, beginning with the pilot episode. I'll do that in a few minutes. First, I want to tell you a little bit about the podcast. This is going to be very lightly, if at all, edited, because, quite frankly, I have found that sitting in front of a computer editing is not for me. Of course, if somebody wants to offer to edit, I'd be glad to have them do that. Also, let's talk a little bit about my relationship with the Doom Patrol and why I felt this was an important series for me to cover first. Doom Patrol is one of my favorite intellectual properties, my favorite comic book series. I have read pretty much some, if not all, of every version of the book, save for the most recent one, the Gerard Way one, because I gave up comic reading in 2011. It's a very close property to me, in a way, mainly because the Doom Patrol has Arnold Drake and Bruno Pirmiani created it. They've given creators credit, although this series should also give creator credit to Grant Morrison and Richard Case, but we'll get to that in a moment. What I think Drake was intending was that this is a series about people with disabilities, people who have traumatic experiences in their lives that change their physicality and how they make their lives normal again, and how they give back to society, even though society is like looking at them funny. That means a lot to me. I mean, it's basically my X-Men, because I'm a person with a mental illness, so I have a disability, not an obvious one. So a lot of people don't understand when I have an episode why or what I'm doing. It means a lot to me. The Arnold Drake and Bruno Pirmiani series, I still own the collected edition of the entire run on the book that they had. The other run that I really, really absolutely respond to is the Grant Morrison and Richard Case run, which happened after the Paul Kupferberg tried twice to revive the Doom Patrol, once in the 70s as part of a revival of the Showcase comic, and again in its own comic in the 80s. And Kupferberg emphasized more the superhero-y aspects and the fact that his characters tended to not be as injured as Drake's characters kind of bore this out. Morrison pulled it back. In fact, Drake has been cited as saying in interviews that the only run of Doom Patrol that he thinks got what he was getting at was the Grant Morrison run. Grant Morrison also put in a whole lot of absurdism, a very strange sense of humor, and it is obvious to me that even though they give Arnold Drake, Bruno Pirmiani, and for some bizarre reason Bob Haney creator credit, they are all about the Morrison. Almost all the characters are from the Morrison run, except for the original three Doom Patrollers, and two of them are designed to look like they looked during the Morrison run. Episodes 4 and 5 are a direct, absolute direct adaptation of one of Morrison's story arcs. They want to be Morrison. Okay, the pilot for Doom Patrol, episode 1, untitled episode, aired on the 15th of February, 2019. It is 58 minutes long. It was directed by Glenn Winter and written by Jeremy Carver. What it starts out with first is a really annoying narration. Actually, no, I stand corrected. What it really starts out with is a title sequence that just drives home to me what people have been telling to me about the Titans series. Titans are another comic series that I'm very close to, but I just can't bear to see it because I feel like I'm going to be just angry all the time watching it. The DC Universe streaming service TV series are really, really supposed to be their answer to the Marvel Netflix series. The title sequence is very, very reminiscent with its downbeat music and its strange imagery, and I did not look forward to it. Then we get the narration of Mr. Morden, who is a character originally created by Arnold Drake as a guy with a big robot, but was transformed by Grant Morrison and Richard Case into Mr. Nobody. Turns out he's going to be the narrator for the entire series, and he's played by Alan Tudyk. I have great respect for Alan Tudyk. I like Alan Tudyk. Alan Tudyk is a good actor, but my God, this thing is annoying. The narration I feel like doing that Madeline Kahn thing from Clue. Flames going through my head. It's very self-aware. It's very kind of jokey. And I think this comes to what is, I think, one of the major problems with the show is that it knows it has to have a sense of humor, but its sense of humor is not the Doom Patrol sense of humor. It's not an absurdist sense of humor. It's much more of a knowing, winking, meta kind of humor, which doesn't sit well with me. It just doesn't. As with a lot of DC material made during the reign of Dan DiDio and Geoff Johns, this series seems to want to be adult, but a 14-year-old idea of adult, namely a lot of cursing, nudity, and violence. This is driven home because after a brief opening scene where Mr. Morden shows up at a cobbler's house in Paraguay, wink wink, for special enhancements that will turn him into Mr. Nobody, we then focus on Cliff Steele, played by Brendan Fraser before he becomes a robot and providing the voice when he becomes a robot. And he is fucking the nanny. And the nanny, think the nanny has all two lines of dialogue, and is basically just there to be a pair of bare breasts. It's just kind of icky that this is what they think being adult is to me. I don't know. Then we get this establishment that Cliff and his wife are not doing too well, and he's fucking the nanny, and he's neglecting his daughter. Then he has an accident. This thing bothers me about all modern day TV shows and a lot of movies as well, is that lately a lot of producers are using music cues that are really on the nose as a replacement for actually doing character development and establishing the sense of place. In this case, when we get to the stock car race, it's 1988. It's established by one of those little title cards. Cliff starts racing to the tune of Sweet's Fox on the Run, which I guess explains why he was asking the nanny to call him the Fox while he was fucking her. The thing that bothered me was that Fox on the Run, of course, is a song from the 70s by a band called Sweet, which is not about what I think they thought it was about. He gets into an accident. At least we think he does. And then we get this sequence that I'm of two minds about, because it's obviously influenced by the famous sequence in RoboCop, where they're rebuilding Peter Weller. I think that it's a little too self-consciously aping that sequence, but on the other hand, there are these little moments. We're introduced to Timothy Dalton, who classes up the joint, because he's Timothy Dalton. He'll class up any joint. We see Larry Traynor, played by Matt Bomer, under mummy wrappings, and April Bowlby, who may very well be one of the more interesting characters in the show, although you wouldn't know it from this episode. There is a moment where he perceives April playing Rita Farr, the Elastigirl, watching one of her old movies and reciting the lines along with it. Throughout this episode, there are these little grace notes that April Bowlby drops that kind of lay the groundwork for her character arc, which wasn't apparent to me until about episode 4. Seeing that how she's preparing for this as early as the pilot is pretty impressive. She is a pretty impressive actress, and she has a great scene that we'll get to later on in this pilot. He eventually wakes up, he finds out he's in a robot body, he is introduced formally to these other characters. During the training, we learn a little bit about everybody's backstory, and here's something that's really bizarre. The producers of this show, I think Jeremy Carver developed the show, made some choices that, best of my knowledge, are new to the show itself. Primary among them is deciding that each of the four original members in this continuity, the three original members plus Jane, who we'll get to in a little bit, come from different decades of the 20th century. I don't understand. Are they trying to make a point with that or something? There is no real reason that these characters couldn't have been contemporaries or near contemporaries. Even the one character who has a storyline that seems very keyed into his identity in contrast to the decade in which he lives, I could still see them doing it in 1995 when the story starts up again, or 2019. I mean, I could see them doing it now because how regressive our country's government has become in regards to trans, homosexual people. It adds a level of complication. There's at least one time here, and there are several times throughout the rest of the series so far, where one of the characters has to remind us that they've known the Chief for 60 years, that they've been around for 70 years. I'm sorry, it just doesn't add anything. They try a little bit to key everybody in. There's some attempt later on to key Jane in with the punk rock movement of the 70s, where she's supposedly from. But we have a punk underground right now. No harm having her be alive then. But her episode comes later, and it's one that I have a lot of problems with. Larry Traynor in this show is homosexual. He's closeted. It's during the 60s. To be fair, Morrison portrayed him as genderless, non-binary, I guess we call it now. And if I get the phrasing wrong, please, people, correct me. Politely, though. So I can understand why they thought it was a simple step from being non-binary, genderless, to being a closeted homosexual, I guess. But once again, I don't think it adds anything to Larry's character. Just like making Rita Farr a 50s movie actress as opposed to a contemporary actress, I don't see that adding anything. It bothers me. I should also point out that another thing that they've done that really kind of confuses me. In the comics, at least everyone that I have read, and I've read pretty much everything except for the Gerard Way version, so if this is a Gerard Way thing, I'm sorry, I didn't realize. Rita had the ability to grow and shrink both isolated parts of her body and her whole body to suit her needs. In this, she basically is a blob that is keeping herself in her human form by sheer force of will. Actually, I can maybe kind of see the reasoning behind this change. It makes her more of a freak, so to speak. More disabled, if you will, so she has more of a reason to stick with this group. Or maybe it was to make her fit in more with the very Morrison-esque other three. Rita was the only original character who never appeared in the Morrison series. She was believed dead for a very long time. It was pretty funny considering that she was the one character whose powers could probably have saved her from the fate that the other Doom Patrollers had fallen to. There's this moment where Rita is bonding, kind of, with Cliff. We should talk a little bit about Brendan Fraser. There are some actors, you get the impression that they've done their research. You get the impression Brendan Fraser did his research. The Cliff Steele in this series so far, in the pilot, is recognizably the Cliff Steele from the comic, albeit one with a very, very foul mouth. Fraser seems to be one of those actors that likes to give to his partners in a scene. It always seems like there is an involvement there, and there's a nice moment with him and Rita watching television. It ends, though, in a bizarre joke about her eating three rotisserie chickens that I don't think is ever brought up again. I know I'm hammering this Morrison Case thing real hard, but Cliff's design, Larry's design, obviously Jane's design, because Jane was a Morrison Case creation, are directly lifted from the Morrison Case series run, And there's no real explanation for why Cliff is running around wearing various different heavy metal t-shirts and a leather jacket and jeans. I really, really, really was appreciative of Frasier's performance. Frasier gets Cliff, gets why his disability hurts him so much, why his time-lossedness, because of course he's from 88 and here it is 2019 in the show, and this affects him. I just wish they would tone down the language, because there are times when literally his lines are just repeating what the fuck over and over again. We come back to a sequence where Cliff remembers what really happened that night when he had the accident. Unfortunately, we also have more of Alan Tudyk's narration. I can't emphasize enough, this narration is a mood killer. The funny thing is, the best episodes of this show are the one where we don't have the Alan Tudyk narration. That sets us up for the MVP of the show. The actor who is the best fit for her character. A character who instantly creates a spine for the show. Namely, Diane Guerrero as Crazy Jane. She is that character. She is very, very on point. She automatically... I have to wonder if she and Brendan Fraser worked something out. Offset, because there is a definite rapport almost from day one between the two characters, and that was major spine of the Morrison Case run. And Jane and Cliff are shaping up to be the spine in the series. I cannot emphasize enough how great Guerrero is. Guerrero is the best thing in the show. And considering that she's acting opposite Brendan Fraser and Timothy Dalton, who are both pretty decent actors, in case of Timothy Dalton, pretty damn good. That's impressive. The chief decides to go off for a while. Jane kind of press gangs everybody into going on a field trip down to Cloverton, which I think actually is a Rachel Pollack. Rachel Pollack was the writer who took over after Morrison in the 80s and 90s run of Doom Patrol. And I think Cloverton was one of her ideas, which is kind of unusual. It's a peculiar sequence where they're driving into town on literally a short bus, painted black. Once again, as I pointed out, Doom Patrol in the comics is very much a story about people with disabilities learning to interact with society and give back to it. Maybe that's a little on the nose, and their vehicle being a short bus makes a kind of sense. Two things occurred to me during this one little sequence. One, I don't know why they chose to use the instrumental break from Total Coelho's 1980s hit, I.E. Cannibals. I don't even think it was much of a hit here in the States. And I think I may be the only person who remembers the name Total Coelho. I've mentioned this before about April Bowerby having these grace notes she likes to drop in. There's this moment of her kind of leaning out the car window and one hand kind of luxuriating in the breeze, which kind of brought home how sheltered she'd been until that point, and how much she must have missed being out in the sunlight. While Guerrero and Fraser and Dalton are more apparently actorly actors, Bowlby is subtly very, very clever. I give her a lot of credit. They get into town, and we get little vignettes. We get Larry going into a bar to get a beer, and that's where we first learn about his closet homosexuality. We get Jane and Cliff buying a toy for his daughter because he forgot one the year before the accident. There is some great bonding scenes with the two of them. The producers have this thing where Jane, for those of you who are not quite familiar with the characters, Jane is a character who, in the comics, it was because of the invasion crossover, and she was exposed to the metabomb. We don't know yet why, but she has 64 different personalities, each personality having its own unique superpower. Not surprisingly, we get more of certain personalities than others. The main ones that seem to come out more often than not are Hammerhead, which is kind of a punk rock chick who I think has some sort of enhanced strength. A character who I don't think has a name yet, who can cause her words to become silvery sharp objects, literally. And Baby Doll, who I think has some sort of psychic abilities. And Flit. Flit doesn't really speak, so Flit is a teleporter. It gets the Doom Patrol. They do this thing whenever she's switching personalities, there's a shimmer around her. And I don't think they need that, because Guerrera's acting is so strong that you can tell when she is transitioning back and forth between characters. I think it's doing her a disservice. They buy a toy and they get into a little bit of trouble. And then there's Rita. Rita goes into a diner to get a malted and a burger. And she gets into this moment, and this is Bowlby being really, really intriguing, if you ask me. The owner of the diner is someone whose father loved Rita Farr, and she bonded with him over the movies of Rita Farr. And at first you think she's fascinated by this because it means they're talking about her. It's all ego, but I think it's something else. The fact that her efforts had some sort of meaning emboldens her, and she becomes a little more outgoing in that scene, and it works until, of course, we hear that apparently a Rita Farr lookalike was doing porn after she disappeared because she was a blob. That causes her to revert to her blobby form. That causes chaos. The negative being that lives in Larry's body comes out and shorts out a bunch of stuff. Cliff and Jane have to stop Rita from accidentally hurting a busload of children. And this manages to bring them to the attention of Mr. Nobody. The chief, Timothy Dalton's character, his thing is, let's get out of Cloverton, go hide somewhere. Cliff is more, no, what about these people in the town? They're kind of fucked if we leave. They end up eventually staying, and then there's a donkey. We saw a donkey in the very beginning, and we saw a donkey towards the end of the pilot, and the donkey shows up again to fart out what is, I think, Mr. Nobody's catchphrase, the mind has no limits. We see Tudyk in his full Mr. Nobody form, and then there's a big sinkhole. We cut to the credits. Here's the thing, and this is going to be, I think, a major theme when we talk about this series. There are some things that they get really badly. There are some things that they do that I just don't understand. But what they get right spectacularly. And some of that is partly the fault of the actors, Frasier, and especially Guerrero, Bowlby, who I'm learning in this second watch of these earlier shows, was planting seeds far, far before the developments came into being. Dalton, of course, they get absolutely spectacular, and it feels like the Doom Patrol that I grew up reading. We're not going to get totally, absolutely, comfortably Doom Patrol until episodes 4 and 5, which are the Morrison Decreator arc, and beyond. I think that they start getting the right mix. But right now, as with any pilot, they're kind of feeling their way around. If it wasn't for the acting, chances are I would not have watched beyond the first episode. But I was so engaged by Guerrero and Frasier and Dalton, and also by Bowlby. We should mention Matt Bomer plays Larry Traynor, but Matt Bomer, who my therapist likes to refer to as a snack, he kind of grows into the character a bit more as we go further into the series. But right now, he's just kind of... In the scene where he has the beer, there's this awful Alan Tudyk narration that pretty much spells out the character arc for him. We shouldn't have to do that. The thing with the other characters is that there seem to be active participants in their character arc. Right now, Bomer's Larry Traynor just seems to have his character arc thrust upon him. So it was enough, though, to keep me watching. And it's kept me watching through to the present episode, was episode 8. And we will discuss this more. Usually I like to use a scale that was pioneered by Whitney Seibold and William Bibiani, which is don't recommend, recommend, and this is a high A. It wasn't for the acting. The chances are we would not be having this discussion right now. But the acting wins me over all the really lame and some of the joke. Wait till we get to the cockroach voiced by Booger in, I think, episode 2. Some of the stuff is just not funny. And they're trying hard to be funny. The violence, when we get to episode 3, there's a particular tableau of violence that's really off-putting. They kind of understand what they're doing, but not quite. But they understood enough that I was able to intrigue me as a longtime Doom Patrol fan to continue watching. That's episode 1. Episode 2, you'll be pleased to know, I will have a guest on. My compadre from the With Umbrella, Charm, and Bowler podcast, Scott McGregor, will be on to help me dissect episode 2, Donkey Patrol. Guys, if you like this, first off, there's lots of stuff on Two True Freaks done by myself and other freaks, like the Honeywell Experiment, where Chris Honeywell and I explore grindhouse movies. The Jack and Eddie Boys do great work with monster movies, both of the past and of the Japanese variety. If you want to assure yourself that more of this will be coming on a regular basis, I invite you to join my Patreon page, which is at patreon.com/DJ's Domicile of Dread. For as little as $1 a month, you'll get special writerly things exclusive to the Patreon. And for more money, you will get exclusive content, including a Patreon-only podcast called Cinematic Mirage. I'm going to have to talk to Chris about setting up a email address for this thing so you guys can send me letters and tell me how out of touch and screwed up I am. Otherwise, you'll see me again in a couple of weeks with Scott this time. I'll see you soon for Donkey Patrol. Good night. You've been listening to a 2019 episode of Thomas DJ's Watching, a Domicile of Dread production in association with the DiMonzo Corporation and the International Association of Mildly Disgruntled Scientists. All views are my own, and I stand behind every one of them, unless you're listening to this years and years into the future, at which point my opinion may have changed, and or I may have died. If you want to support this podcast and podcaster, please consider becoming a Domicile of Dread Patreon at patreon.com, DJ's Domicile of Dread. Tiers start at $1 a month, and you'll get fun stuff in return, including early access to the raw, unedited feed of this very podcast. There might be cursing and stuff. Please check out the other great podcasts available on the Two True Freaks Podcast Network. Until next time, close that refrigerator door. You're going to let all the coldness that you saved up out overnight.